you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the second part of episode 36, where we are discussing Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax, Work, Debt, and Insecurity in the Area of Uberization, published in the Journal of Organization Studies in 2017. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. In this part of the podcast, we're going to discuss implications for practice, because all of us had ideas about what three other topics of study this might spawn, where the perspectives inform and maybe don't inform us as well as we might like, and therefore more research is necessary. And we're also going to take a look at some things that we think maybe Fleming left out of the article, or that there's another perspective, and that is of management, because Fleming does a really good job of looking at this from the perspective of the individual worker. But there are other trends at work here that we believe are worthy of consideration.
So after reading the Fleming paper and the thoughts about it, I took a look at what other literature might be available on the topic. Because Fleming's paper is so recent, there's very little published literature. And we've loaded two papers, or at least I found two papers, Workers in the Gig Economy by a number of students at Tilburg University, or Tilburg, because it's, I believe, in the Netherlands. And another article by Mumby and a number of other authors on resistance. And Mumby comes out of the school of resistance. And so they look at casting the ideas of resistance in the context of human capital and what can we do. I became interested, especially after reading the Mumby paper, in the how likely or how effective or how credible are some of their concepts as far as being able to be executed. And so, you know, if we take a look at it, they have a table called Table 1 in their paper 42, where they look at a model of four I's: individual infrapolitics, collective infrapolitics, insubordination, and insurrection. And yes, insurrection does include insurrection in its traditional meaning, as well as some lower forms of insurrection, like hunger strikes and that stuff. And when you look at the perspectives, my question is, we talked earlier in the first half about having something in the app to allow the drivers to talk amongst themselves, and came to the conclusion that the app provider or the contracting organization would be unlikely to do that. So that means that the app has to be provided externally by someone. And since apps are so relatively easy to create, I would see the potential for an app to coordinate people to be likely to be able to be created, that would be a likely possible strategy. And then it becomes one of attracting significant enough attention that people are willing to download the app and then take the action. And we certainly have examples of flash mobs and whatnot where people are willing to do that. So that's where I was at when I was trying to figure this out. Fundamentally, my approach is driven by the concern for societal instability as a result of unintended consequences, and not necessarily from the same perspective as Fleming or Mumby, but more from the preservationist perspective of what elements do we have to have enough of in society so that we remain stable and don't fall off the edge of a cliff.
And that's a great systems level view. And I know you tend to favor systems level view like I do. And what I like about that approach, and I think is very insightful, is that you're taking it up a notch and you're saying, all right, well, there's these issues that the individuals are dealing with. And then you're looking at, well, how does that feed into society overall? Which I think is a really great way to look at it.
Yes. Well, so from my perspective as a practitioner, I'm often involved in setting, in helping people find policy, set policy, write policy. And so that's why I tend to go to that governance level, if you will, because that's where I'm interested. And then it's a matter of helping the policy writers, because I'm these days rarely the person who gets to actually set the policy, think through the unintended consequences of what they do and what would be the trip points or the set points or the way markers that they would look for to see that additional action is required, or do you take that additional action right from the very beginning?
So do you see that as a possible research topic where you would say, not necessarily just in a very general, but you're looking at something where you're outsourcing or you're making some big change like that, and then you might either look at a case study where you'd say, okay, how did the company and its workers resolve these things, or what mediums were in place? How do you see that might be operationalized as a research topic?
So I see a research question that can be answered by a number of cases. And the question would be, what forces have allowed the balance of power shift that creates or shifts the extraction of more value by the organization from the workforce? And that's just a first pass or second pass at that question. And one approach to that would be a set of cases that would attempt to, then be able to be generalized to the forces. And then the follow-on question is, so now what do you do about it? What actions, if any, or what strategies, if any, would be effective in turning some of those forces towards a greater societal benefit?
Right, because that's one thing I found a little unsatisfying about Fleming's paper was at the end, he says, well, government should get more involved and we should, it was these very high-level kinds of activities. So what I like about that idea, Joe, is that you're trying to look at, well, what would happen? What would some of these drivers be, as opposed to just saying, well, we have to roll back to the way work was in the past.
Yeah, but one of the things I want to point out about Mumby's paper, the four forms of resistance that he suggests is very good in terms of a descriptive form of the different ways in which resistance can manifest themselves. In terms of what's the purpose for the resistance and what forms of resistance can take place. So when we talk about the infrapolitics all the way up to insurrection, those certainly are useful descriptors, and we can see where different types of resistance that occurs that they lay out and that we've discussed so far can be made manifest and be identified or classified. But the part that, and I think this kind of gets to the aspects of where this maps into policy, is that there are some other questions about or dimensions of resistance that I don't know that this paper necessarily covers that I think raise some interesting questions. And I use as the inspiration for this the description of insubordination, which is on Mumby's page 23, where insubordination is defined as sensible insubordination shifts our attention to how people struggle individually and openly through practices such as, and note the interesting list here, misbehavior, whistleblowing, hunger, and hunger strikes. And what struck me in that was that those three represent three very different forms of resistance from, say, an ethical standpoint. So what I want to do is to kind of, and what I mean by an ethical standpoint is when I think about how we look at acts of resistance now, there's the sense that I have that we have some division within our society in terms of what kinds of acts of resistance are considered either acceptable or unacceptable, or honorable or dishonorable, or what have you. There's some sort of a dimension that's worth exploring, because different parts of society view things such as whistleblowing or hunger strikes for particular purposes as being an honorable and justifiable act, whereas perhaps other forms of resistance, especially in the current discourse about whether violence, explicit violence is used.
Right, violence is a big one.
you have a, you know, it's not as much as some commentators may look at violence as just being universally bad. There really is a sharp divide, I think, in terms of what's considered an acceptable use of violence to resist versus what's not acceptable. And in order to, if we're going to come up with policy, that some of those ethical dimensions of what's considered the resistance that we would want to not discourage, like whistleblowing, versus those we would want to actively discourage, is actually a very complicated question.
Do you think that this discussion, these different forms of resistance, and wondering what kind of strategies could be the ones that, as a society, we could support. Do you see any link with the whole issue about the Uberization, that ones we were talking about before, of, you know, what kind of specific strategies could we support, could make sense for something that is diffused and hard to pin down, as the emergence of a new employment organizational format?
So I think that's an excellent research area, and that was actually my second research question, which goes along the lines of a number of authors have begun to look at how to shift the balance back to the workforce. How credible or executable are their suggestions? When you look at, you know, Uber, there have been protests that have turned violent. You know, there have been people killed, actually, Uber drivers killed. A number of Uber taxis destroyed, which are actually usually their own vehicle. And so you do have that whole spectrum of, you know, from blocking drivers to violence. You know, blocking would be a relatively nonviolent, assuming that people don't actually start bumping each other with the vehicles, all the way to violence. And I think it's worthwhile, or that would be good research. And then the part that I'd be looking for is, are there cultural aspects that determine the effectiveness of the various strategies, or are only certain strategies effective in certain cultures, would be a way to look at it.
The other dimension that I'd like to raise in this too is, when it comes to resistance, is who's the target? And one of the things that when I think about the historical examples, the target was extremely tangible. I mean, when we're talking about going back to the time of Taylorism and subsequently, it was the dude running the firm. I mean, you know, whether man or woman running the firm, that was the person burned in effigy, because that was the person who was setting the conditions under which resistance was necessary.
Right.
I mean, that's a gross oversimplification, but that's kind of the way that people thought. You know, there was a sense that there was a person that they could touch that would be influenced by the resistance. Who are we resisting against now? I mean, when we're talking about Uber, we're talking about a very, very broad global economic movement. And so then the in the case of the United States, it winds up being far less tangible targets, like whether it's a particular person in office, whether it's the flag, whether it's other national symbols, or something even more abstract. It's sort of like the resistance, the need for resistance is definitely there, but without a very, very clear, tangible target in existence, then they identify, you know, you identify or create a target almost as a straw man to say, well, you know, we're mad, so we're going to take it out here. But the fact that it's an intangible target makes it difficult to imagine how the outcome of the resistance is going to have the same kind of impact as when you really had a firm, concrete understanding of who your target was previously.
So that's a great point. And I want to concretize that for just a moment. So connection with, I'll be very specific, is in the United States right now, we're dealing with concerns, societal concerns about police brutality or police interactions with minorities and excessive uses of force. Those are some of the big picture issues. And we have professional athletes in this particular case in the National Football League, which is a very big money sport, very popular in the United States, not standing for the national anthem. which is played at the beginning of all our outdoor sporting events. And these issues that Tom is asking are being raised right now in that, all right, if you are protesting police brutality and more equal treatment of minorities, who actually do you think is going to be impacted by this? Who are you resisting and how do you expect to influence them? And the challenge that is starting to occur, or the conflict, one of the conflicts that's starting to occur is the fans don't have any, you know, are not pressuring their individual police forces. They're mad at the players for the stance they're taking to the national anthem and symbology of national unity, which many people consider an assault on, you know, cultural values. So one might ask, okay, because I think this gets to Joe's idea about the, you know, kinds of resistance. But what kinds of resistance actually get in the way of influencing the party? Because I will tell you, where I would take Tom's point was, yes, not only who is the target, but who are you trying to influence, right? That's really the issue. So is it the owners in this case of the teams? Is it, you know, individual police departments? That's very confusing and makes it hard to follow who the influence body is supposed to be, which I think is a big challenge.
Well, I think this shows exactly the power of the essay by Fleming, because he's trying to link something that we are seeing happening to a greater ideology, set of ideas, set of, you know, prepackaged justifications that can be used, again, by firms in, you know, legal discussions, in day-to-day operations by HR people, in, I don't know, the way that you go to bed and think if that is okay or not to treat people as contractors, even though they are not necessarily, they are really just your employees, you know. So, and I don't want to get too political and unpack the whole issues about racism and police brutality, but I think one of the issues is exactly that, you know, to showcase that there's a real phenomenon that exists, that racism is tangible and has consequences.
That's how you start, is get the issue on the table, get these ideas identified, because he never claimed in the article he was trying to solve all these things. He gave some suggestions, and these are the larger societal forces at play where you have to decide, okay, then where do you go next? Because I thought Joe's comment about, how do you go work on the balancing of the value extraction from the employment contract when it's not just Uber and Lyft. You know, these are larger forces in the economy where, in many cases in hospitals, the doctors don't work for the hospital. They are actually contractors to the hospital. So it's happening across professions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to give an example, we have Uber and Lyft, but, you know, if it's neither of them, can be a third, a fourth, any yes. other one that creates an app. You know, so that's why it creates this, you know, it complicates, as we were saying before, there is no one person in charge. Anyone can create an app and put it out there and, you know, maybe the issue emerge again. So I think we did a good job at, you know, expanding and complexifying the whole issue of resistance in light of the paper, of the essay. So I think another issue that was, I think, not really explored, maybe Fleming is looking more at the individualized worker, but he doesn't look so much at the perspective of the firm.
One of the papers, and I think it wasn't the Mumby paper, it was the other one.
Giannis.
Yes. They talked about how it applies to universities, right? That this kind of de-skilling of the work and then the massively open online courses and other forms of competition are a risk, a challenge, probably is the best way to say it, for universities, for their original teaching model. And you see now in U.S. universities, and I think the trend is similar overseas, where a lot of the researchers are hired on part-time contracts and for specific durations of time, and that the number of permanent faculty is actually smaller because it's a way to bring down the costs of providing the education. So it doesn't just apply to what you might call lower-skilled work. And that's why I thought it was brilliant that Fleming started out with airline pilots, because that really got my attention to realize, oh my gosh, this is, you know, it's that 70% of these guys are actually not part of the company. Now, I do think Fleming glossed over this idea that, okay, they buy uniforms and they have to, you know, pay for their hotel rooms in foreign cities, which I'm not advocating, or pay for hotel rooms in cities outside their normal work area or living area. But they're still doing centralized training. That's, you know, those things are requirements in that industry. I think they probably wouldn't do it out of the goodness of their heart. It's probably required by the regulators. So there's this there is this role of the government to, you know, to be involved, because it is entirely possible if it wasn't required, they wouldn't do it, which that is scary.
So let's think about, if we can, from the management perspective, and go back to airline pilots. So traditionally in the United States, airline pilots get their first X hundreds to thousands of hours in a smaller airline that sounds more like the one that was discussed in Fleming's paper, where they're contractors. And then they move up to one of the mainline carriers, where they then work for extended periods of time, like 20, 30, 40 years, if they can. But what happens when the FAA changes the rule? And if you largely had a contract feeder force who don't make it to the 1,500 hours now because they thought they only had to live in hell for, you know, do their apprenticeship for 250 hours, and it's clearly not worth it to do that to get to the 1,500 hours, then the mainline carrier loses their feeder, their supply. So, you know, if you're looking at it from a management perspective in just that one case, if you're depending on the development of a skill set that gets to you fairly well developed, where are you then in the management of your business if you're not going to get that skill set?
Yeah, that's a great point. You get yourself aligned for this influx of talent, you know, that somebody else is providing. And what happens when it goes away? And what you often see reported in business press is, oh, well, there's a shortage of airline pilots. There's a shortage of nurses. I wonder, right? I wonder, okay, but perhaps there's also labor policies that, like Joe was talking about, that actually cause those shortages and are a consequence of that. And therefore, it disrupts your entire business model.
It's something that's not in the article, but could be there. It's actually another unexpected negative consequence of, you know, leaving everything to chance and pretending everyone can just go about and, you know, buy your own skills and provide your own skills. And then you have these uneven situations in the market in which you don't have the skills.
One of the things that I think about when I think about the manager situation is we talked about how, from the individual perspective, they can look at these sorts of movements as the organization trying to save money. But then when we look at the overall global economy and how it's shifting, these firms, I mean, we talk about these hospitals, for example, who are trying to provide a service of which the demand for service is increasing at the same time that there's tremendous economic pressures to try to keep costs low and to be more efficient. So on the one hand, we can talk about things that we want to do to try to change this balance of power between the firm and the individual member. But I always think that there has to be a commensurate discussion about how do we change the economic pressures on the firms themselves, because they're being driven. You know, even if they perhaps in the advent of human capital theory, they may not have, it may have been a little bit more elective that we decided, oh, this sounds like a great idea. We can save money, yada, yada. Nowadays, it's hard to imagine how you can reverse the trend that's all the economic pressures to drive costs lower for the consumer, which in the case of hospitals involves insurance companies as well, which would facilitate or foster the ability to provide or to change the relationship between the firm and some of its members. Because I don't see economic pressures getting lighter in any way. It's going to get tougher. It's going to get stronger, more competitive. And it's driving, for example, consolidation of hospitals under fewer and fewer conglomerates, which is even further putting pressure on remaining firms to stay competitive.
Yeah, and I think that argues for the more systemic view Joe was talking about, where if you just say, well, Uber should do this or this organization should do that, and you don't look at the larger driving forces, I don't know if you're going to have much success doing that.
And the problem is, I forget which article did mention this, but there's already a bit of cynicism built out there about, say, superficial efforts at it, the social responsibility, which unfortunately devolved into a fad, but is actually the intent behind it is still kind of resonates, of where firms and government in the context that we're discussing – need to have some sort of a better sense of ownership of the good or the welfare of the people. Because right now it's the public-private divide. It's sort of it's almost competitive, and neither side wants to take the full responsibility.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 36. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or via our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next time as we discuss part 3 of Peter Fleming's The Human Capital Hoax, Work, Debt, and Insecurity in the Era of Uberization, here on Talking About Organizations.